Hi friends, and welcome to the Universal Sisterhood podcast. We're hoping to create a place where women can delve deeper, lift their gaze higher, live freer, laugh louder, smile brighter, and be the authentic woman she was designed to be. Every human heart has been created to be seen, known, and loved. So this is the place where women can share their story. Welcome to episode 113. In today's episode, I have the absolute privilege of chatting with Anna Crone. Anna lives in Ballarat, Victoria with her husband and has spent most of her life as serving her local Catholic community. She has a sharp mind and a servant heart. She is humble, joyful, and such a delight to chat to. I know you're going to love her too. I can't wait for you to listen to this episode. Anna has achieved so much in her life, and I for one am very grateful for the work, the effort, and the love she has put into giving back to her Catholic faith. I hope you're going to enjoy this episode. If you do, share it with a friend so that others can see the true beauty of what it means to be a Catholic woman. Before we dive into the conversation today with Anna, I just want to apologize for really poor quality recording. We had a few issues with her microphone, so bear with it. You won't be disappointed listening to the gentle, humble, yet powerful voice of Anna Crone. Anna, before we start the conversation, I would love for you to tell us who you are and what your life looks like right now.
Well, anyone who knows me, that probably I'm trying to do about five things at the same time, and that hasn't changed for a lot, most of my life. But then I imagine most of your listeners are trying to do that in one way or another as well. Uh-huh. So I live in the city of Ballarat, the regional city of Ballarat, and I work as an adult educator. That's a kind of broad description of what I do. At the moment, I'm the executive director of the Thomas More Centre part-time, which is a formational organisation that I worked with back in 1990. So I've been asked to come back and try and revive adult formation programs and events for that organisation. But I also am the convener of the Anima Women's Network, which was started in 2003, a sort of online and event-based project. And I've just finished being the state president of the Catholic Women's League of Victoria and Wagga Wagga, and I'm on quite a number of boards and committees. So between all of those things, I write, and I've also just completed teaching an intensive course on theology of the body at University of Notre Dame, Australia. So I do lectures sometimes at university, but more often in settings like parishes or staff formation.
Wow, you are a very busy and accomplished woman.
I don't know about that, but I am busy, I can tell you that.
Well done you. My goodness.
It all grows out of each other, so it's a bit hard to know where it all started.
Yeah, but, well, I did read.
I just call myself an educator, but I remember it was a bit of a problem because when I was trying to open a bank account for one of the many volunteer organisations I worked with, they said, "What's an educator?" And I went, "Oh, I've got to try and explain what that is."
No, there is a role. There's a role. Is it a school educator? A family educator, that's what it is. I have a few friends who are family educators. Is that a similar role?
Probably is. The reason I use that word is that it's probably being a teacher, because I have taught in school, and I've taught at university level, and I've taught in parishes. So I use the word educator just because often people associate teaching with a particular profession, you know, in a particular part of a profession. But a formator and an educator is really closer to what I do. So it's very hard when you've got spaces in forms. There's only a very small space to describe what you do. So you have to have something that actually fits into a box.
And there is something that you left out.
And what's that?
There is something you left out, because in my little hurry, quickly Google search of you, I found that you won you received the Order of Australia medal a few years ago from
the Queen. That was a real surprise. Yes, I did. And it was a bit of an honour because, as you know, one of the areas of my work is with women, especially in the faith. And it was quite something to receive announcement that from the Commonwealth to me for service to the Catholic Church, which was an unusual award in the sense that it's often for a particular charity or for a particular part of the community. But this was a very broad heading, which surprised me, and I had no idea that it was coming.
Wow.
But the real honour and the point part of it all was that I received the medal that was on September, 2 days after, 2 days before the Queen died. So I felt like it was one of her last little signatures was on the awards that went out that year. So that was very moving.
Wow, that there is such intentionality there. Nothing happens by chance, Anna.
Yeah, well, she's a pretty extraordinary figure. The more you look at her life and the more you look at her character, and I felt there was something in that.
Wow.
Something quite moving about that. So,
and didn't she die on a feast day of Our Lady? Was that?
She did. Yeah, she did. Yeah.
So
there's a whole lot of really interesting things there.
Yeah. That's really, really beautiful, actually.
I felt there was something very, and when I received the medal, this was 2 days before anybody had any suspicion that anything was going to happen. The governor of Victoria, who was awarding the medal, said to me, "So what do you do?" And I said, "Well, I work mainly in education and formation at what I might call the community level." She said, "I'd be so interested to talk to you about that." So we didn't have time, obviously, but I thought it actually provoked a lot of interest in the people who were there for that event. And I live in a regional city, and quite a few of the papers in that city came and interviewed me. So it was a great opportunity to talk about the amazing women of faith in our region. So that was great.
Well done.
That was really a time to witness to the work that a lot of the women have done in building up the communities in Western Victoria. And I imagine that many of those women will be involved now helping families whose houses have been lost or who have been evacuated due to the bushfires. I'm sure some of those women will be, you know, raising money to help in that area. So it's really quite an honour to represent them. That's how I see the award, really representing all the teams of women that I've worked with.
Yeah, that's really, really special because I imagine a lot of your work is very hidden work, you know, background work, nothing on the centre stage. And here we are to, you know, the Queen, one of the last things that she has awarded is to you.
I felt it was, there was something very touching about that. And I thought, yes, it was, I often say, look, the only reason I've received the award is because I work with, networking is one of the things that I have been doing a lot of. And I think joining older women to younger women and so on, having events where we bring people together. Thomas More work I'm doing is bringing different generations together as well. So I feel in a way that it's just like being in the switch point between a whole lot of different communities and groups.
Yeah, I find I run retreats, and one of the most beautiful aspects of it is seeing the integration, like the ages and stages all coming together, sharing their faith. It's so uplifting for both the older people to see the younger ones and the younger ones to see the older people living out their faith. It's really inspirational, and it was one of the surprising joys that I have seen in these retreats.
Yeah, I'm very committed to the kind of what I call intergenerational wisdom, because I can tell you that I was lucky enough and blessed to be born into an intergenerational family. My grandfather lived downstairs, and we often had visitors, uncles and aunts, living in various rooms in the house downstairs, and my parents and my sisters and brothers lived upstairs for a time in a large house. And so we used to run down the stairs to see my grandfather in the morning, and we often had his friends or his relatives visiting, so that it was a bit like being in a very small village. And I remember when I went to school, I was a bit shocked. I came home from grade prep and I said to my mother, I don't want to go back. And she said, what do you mean? I said, there's only kids that are five there. And I said, they're only all the same age. And she said, well, that's what school is. I said, but it's all just the same age. I found it very strange that you had to learn in that way. Yeah. So I think that's just an insight into what stayed with me for a long time. And that was how my first 5 years, I guess, were involved with interacting with adults and older cousins and, you know, uncles and aunts.
Yeah.
Great aunts, sort of thing. So we had an unusual upbringing. I think that wasn't the norm for a lot of Australian families at that time.
Yeah, but it was the norm for families many centuries ago, and maybe the way it should be.
Look, I think we're really learning a lot. You know that great TV series, which I think is called Age Care in Kindergarten or something? That series, that social, was a social studies class to try experiment to see how older people would be if they interacted with kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
And kindergarten was students. Little kids, and it's a marvellous series if anyone gets a chance to see it, because the older people suddenly get a whole sense of belonging and their role in forming some of the young people, especially some of the little ones with a few disturbing behaviours and things like that, is really interesting.
And I maybe have
something
seen
that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they did another one with teenagers and aged care too. I didn't see that one, but I think it just shows you that we've perhaps put people in filing cabinets a little bit too long.
Or too long and too quickly.
I think obviously some things we do, because we develop at a certain stage, it's sensible to look at developmental age in education, but a lot of opportunity for more informal education where people work across generations.
Absolutely. That's something that we really are lacking in our world today, that they don't, everyone's quite insular. They, you know, go home and they go on their devices, and like even within homes they don't socialize much anymore.
That's right. I was talking to one of the priests involved in seminary formation down here, and he said he's made a rule that no one's to use their mobile phone in the dining room. And I think that's an interesting rule, because it immediately stops people having alternative conversations. They have to be present to the people, the other seminarians in the room. And I think it's not a bad rule for families to ban, you know, just have a time out from all the devices.
Yeah. It requires a lot of discipline, because you do think that, oh, you're needed. You know, I have to finish this, or I have to talk to this. She's waiting for a response. People don't know how to wait anymore. And we don't know how to make people wait.
There's somebody who did a great, it might have been a writer like Stephen Fry, who said he considered the mobile phone one of the rudest things in existence, because it rings the demands you to answer it. And you actually feel a bit guilty, don't you, if you can't answer it.
Yep.
And you say, I'll just have to let that go through. You feel the guilt. It's like leaving someone standing knocking at the door. And yet it's not like that at all, because especially spam telephone calls are just automatic buttons being pushed and intruding into your space. So I think he's sometimes, if you think of it like that, you do feel, hang on, I've got to put that person in a queue, because I'm actually doing something important at the moment.
Yeah, something more important. We feel like we're always interrupted, and we feel that we have to live an interrupted life in a bad way.
Yeah, I agree. And I think particularly women suffer from that, because because they do have, they're multi-skilled and they can multitask. I think they're used to being spread very thinly. I think it's time they take back some of their contemplative time. And it sounds like you're doing that in your work as well.
Well, I try. I'm trying.
It's amazing how many women feel guilty about going on retreat or spending time in prayer.
Absolutely. It's it's, I can't afford half an hour. I can't afford a day. I can't afford, you know, two days.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
That's just unheard of.
Really, it's such an important part of even the discipline of knowledge is spending time being present with what you're reading or with what you're listening to. It takes time for the mind and the imagination to digest things. And it's a bit like having fast food all the time. It just leads to digestion. And I think we sometimes have something a bit like that in terms of our thinking and our minds.
I do.
And us as well, you know. So I think sometimes I say no, this is about, you know, slow thinking and slow time. And yeah. It takes people a while to feel that they can do that without letting someone down.
Yeah. We don't, especially women, we don't like letting people down. So we're spread, as you said, very, very thin. And then our patience grows very, very thin.
Exactly. Yeah, people get very irritable and they don't notice they're doing it. It's natural that they would be irritable because they're running out of bandwidth. Yeah. But it's just, they keep insisting, no, I can't stop. I can't do this. I can't stop now. I can't do this. So, yeah, I think maybe during the COVID lockdown, people learned a little bit about how different they were when they were able to stop. And I think there was a lot of other things that people are still recovering from. And I live in the state of Victoria, which went through a very long period of lockdown. So people have had all kinds of emotional upheaval in that time. I think there's still people coming out of that, not quite sure how to reconnect to certain things.
We've lost the beauty of the present moment, as they say, the sacrament of the present moment.
Oh, absolutely. It's a real must read, that book. I was given that once many, many years ago by a young priest, and I remember reading it thinking, gosh, this is really important. But even I think young people's, many of the young people of faith that I know are drawn to the faith, the Catholic faith, with things like adoration and time in the blood of the Blessed Sacrament. And for older people, that can seem unusual. But I remember talking to some young people about why they found it so helpful. And they said, everywhere we go is chatter. Everywhere we go is screen. Everywhere we go is people wanting it. Some sort of interaction. Here we can just be. And so they're very hungry for the opportunity just to be present.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And it's a real phenomenon around the Catholic world, isn't it? You see so many young people drawn to the devotional practice.
Yeah. I remember taking so at our retreats we have adoration. And I remember this woman who had never encountered anything like it before, and she came out and she said, "What just happened?" And I said, "Isn't it beautiful? You're face to face with the Prince of Peace. Like, you can't get much better than any better than that." She said, "I don't know what happened. What was that?"
It's interesting because it really brings together so many aspects of Catholic faith in one place without words. You notice you don't, for somebody who's never seen it before, it still moves them. And I remember when we had adoration in Melbourne, I remember one young fellow going down Brunswick Street, which was then a very hipster sort of part of the world, and he brought a couple of young people back. You know, they're all piercings and tats and everything. And they walked in with him and they just completely fitted in with the sort of silence of the cathedral. Probably they were struck by that as well, but they said, they came out and they said, "That was awesome." And I thought, for once, actually using that word really well, it was kind of awesome.
Yeah.
And also the other thing is, adoration is very inclusive. Mm. You don't have to be a Catholic there. You don't have to be in good faith. You don't have to be, all you have to do is accept that you're going to be there. You don't have to pass any tests at all.
You just show up.
And I think what a relief for people just to have some space where they can just be. They don't have to even speak. They don't have to perform. They don't have to do anything. And I think that's something that young people have really discovered in their lives is important. And a lot of them say that this is a space where they do a lot of discernment of their vocations and so on. Really interesting. And I think my generation, who are older than that, didn't have that experience. We never had that at school.
Mm.
We never were encouraged to do that in our growing up. It wasn't something that people... I grew up in a very strange time, which is between two very different eras in the church. And one era going out, one sort of experimental era, and a real sense of dislocation. So a bit younger than a boomer, but just coming out of boomerism, living up to boomers, they were all around us, and walking into another couple of generations. And so for me, it's really fascinating for me to see so many of the young people who've been, say, on World Youth Day, where they probably picked up the practice.
Mm.
Places like World Youth Day gave them a real teaching. It really taught them that experience, and that stayed with them really for the last generations. I think it's amazing, isn't it?
Mm. So have you always been Catholic?
Yes, I was born into a Catholic family, and a very intellectually and emotionally engaged parents in their faith. They spoke about it at the table. My mother, in a different way to my father, my mother came from an Irish-English family. My father came from an Irish family. My father was very socially engaged, and my mother was too. So we were very lucky, especially I come from a large family. So the first five children were very much engaged with conversations with my parents around the table. So, yeah, been goes way back, and my grandparents as well.
Mm. How blessed. How has your faith shaped you? So are you always responsive to your Catholic faith, or did you leave it for a little while, or what was your journey like?
That's an interesting question. I was always engaged in one way or another. When I left school and the last years of school, I was very engaged in art appreciation and art. My first journey of study was in fine art.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the Catholic faith is an enormous repository of great art. So I think in some ways that beauty of that and the richness of that always kept me hooked.
Mm-hmm.
Various times the relational side of the faith I had to explore in different ways. I think very quickly my father's library became a great source of exploration for me. He had many great books, many spiritual classics, and he would always be encouraging of people to read that. So that was another source of spiritual writers and to raise. We're near the Carmelites in Kew. Carmelite sisters were always in our lives. Those parish priests were very encouraging. So, yeah, I was very blessed. Even though I think I went through thinking about lots of other philosophies as I was growing up, when I was an art student, I was kind of a hippie. I was a vegetarian. I had spiky red hair. I wore Indian clothes. I was in the Melbourne Uni food co-op. I don't think I ever stopped practicing my faith. And I was trying to explore all those sorts of avenues of kind of cultural, artistic life. Never really sent me out of the church, which is interesting.
What do you think kept you? The art?
Partly, but I think also the kind of spiritual journey as well. The depth of what was offered. I always felt that when I looked around at other spiritual visions, I respected them. And actually at one stage, and I did other, you know, I explored other things. I always thought, no, there's such huge depth here. Then as I was going through my studies with fine art, I did 2 years of, I thought, no, I'm being really impractical here. I should do some library studies, something to get me a job. So I did 2 years of library studies, learned how to catalogue books and that kind of thing. And then I thought, really, what do I want people to know about? I really want them to know about the most important things. And I want them to know about the things that really matter. So I enrolled then in a theology degree. So my intention was to come back and be a theological librarian, but I never came back. I kept going to theology, went into teaching and worked in bioethics in a hospital. I think I once explained to somebody that I felt like I was an accidental theologian. That is, that in order to explore how to talk to people about things that matter, I found myself going more deeply into theology. And rather than saying in early life, I'm going to be a theologian or I'm going to do this, I didn't ever say anything like that. I never planned anything like that, but it along with itself.
Yeah, but the stories that he writes are the best stories.
Absolutely. Yeah, the story's been not written by me. That's
sure. Yeah, that's right.
And I do think one thing that I realised is the experience of being dislocated in my experience at school was compensated a lot by my parents' interest and my conversation with my parents and my aunt, my godmother and other people. And I thought, you know, there's something, people have missed out, something of the wholeness, the sort of organic Catholic experience in their life or the organic Christian experience. Somehow or other, our culture's distracting them from that.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there's lots of good things in the culture. But I think that really encouraged me to say I really wanted more and more to be involved with people after they left school. Sometime I was working at St. Vincent's Hospital with Tonti Filippini, who was the first Australian bioethicist working in a Catholic hospital. And the research I had to do there, I had to talk to the media, I had to talk to students. It really engaged me with trying to talk about big issues in ordinary ways, how to put things, how to translate things into language that people understand. So I think that set me on the path of doing the kind of work that I do.
Wow. Are you married, Anna? I don't think I asked you this.
Yes, I am. Yes, I'm married to Anthony. And Anthony is a barrister who works with refugees and people seeking asylum, and he works in immigration law and administrative law. So he's very busy all the time, as you can imagine, trying to people applying to become Australians or to enter the country or to stay in the country or to avoid deportation. And it's quite fraught,
yes,
quite nerve-wracking job he does. He's also involved in, he's the president of a little voluntary Catholic library. He's a Dominican tertiary. So he's about as busy as I am. So together we're pretty manic.
Yeah, do you see each other much?
We do. We do a lot of things together. So that really helps.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
We haven't met each other, which is probably a blessing, because otherwise the children might be left in drawers or under. No, that's not true. We would have looked after them. We have lots of nieces and nephews and lots of sort of adopted children who come to see us. So we're blessed in that.
Beautiful. I didn't quite. Did you say you don't have children?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Sorry, I can't. It's a little bit tricky to hear you, but I'm
sorry.
Doing my best. I'm doing my best.
Yes, I'm sorry. This sounds to be a real thing. At least we don't have echoes anymore.
No. That's right. Can I? Not having children, has that been a as a Catholic woman? Has that been a cross that has been hard to carry?
It has been in one way, but in another sense, I think I've been too engaged with people to have time to feel sorry about that in a way, because it hasn't been, because in some ways I do believe that the words of Pope John Paul II are very true, that every woman has a kind of motherhood.
Mm-hmm.
However that looks. And I think I've been very lucky to know many, many amazing women, married, unmarried, with children and not with children, to see how one of the great things about the Catholic view of women is that it's very unstereotypical.
Yeah.
There really are so many different ways in which people live their lives. I think sometimes other smaller Christian groups have had a much more stereotyped understanding of women's vocations. Mm. But really, all you have to do is look at the lives of the different saints, and you've got everyone from Hildegard of Bingen to Joan of Arc to Mother Teresa. And they're all such different personalities.
Yeah.
They all look different. And yet they're all considered, they all write and also considered holy. So that's always been an encouragement to me.
And however considered that mothers. And
yes,
about their maternity.
We call them mother.
Yeah,
we call them mother for a good reason, because they actually fulfill their motherhood in that way. And that's a great I think even very early in the church's history, the young women who became Christian martyrs could see their vocations not attached to conventional societal norms. But, you know, someone like St. Cecilia defied societal norms. She was expected to marry a wealthy Roman soldier, probably. And she said, no, I'm not going to do it because my vocation is to do this. So it really has given us some amazing examples of women who, in order to fulfill their love for Christ or to follow in a particular mission, have done something quite different. So I always get a bit puzzled when people say, oh, you know, Catholic Church oppresses women, because it's anything but true, especially if you look at these deeply great women in our history. And I think Pope John Paul II and Pope Paul VI both see it, you know, at the hour of recognising how amazing that Paul VI is, that it's the hour to recognise what women have done. And he then started that. He began to focus on the great works that the women saints have done. Now, I think in the medieval time they were recognised as great, but I think during the time of the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution, women in a sense were displaced a little bit. And instead of being, for instance, abbesses of monasteries or hermitesses who everyone came to see, they ended up feeling a little bit on the fringes. And I can see how the feminist movement rose out of a sense of feeling neglected or feeling that there was a lack of meaning in the way women were living their lives. So it's understandable how that occurred, but I think if you dig a little deeper into our traditions, you don't have to go very far to see, not that there's never problems, there's always been problems, there's always been people who oppress women, there's always been people who discover the nature of being sinful, isn't it? But I think we've got so many great examples. And I've had I was working for a time at the John Paul II Institute as a tutor and a student advisor, which was a wonderful privilege. Met students from all over the world who came to study in Melbourne, to study the great teaching of marriage and family and the body and sexuality and the human person and nature that you can find in the teaching of John Paul II. I mean, it's so rich, there's so much you can study just taking out one little tiny idea of your thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So we had coming from Ireland, people coming from Japan, Africa, and to hear their journeys of faith and their courage and their great intelligence in trying to pursue a mission based on that has been a bit of life for me.
So
walking with them.
I love the fact that, as you said, that we're not stereotypical, you know. People hate what they think is the Catholic Church. I think it was Archbishop Fulton Sheen who said that, but no one will hate what the Catholic Church really is. And
well, that's true.
You know, we are not stereotypical. We're all different, and we live out our faith, our Catholic faith, differently, but it is the same faith. It's very human. It's very holy.
You know, holiness, in a sense, I think, makes people more themselves.
Yeah.
When we understand that holiness is really a fulfillment and a transfiguration of the human too. So it's fulfilling all the human aspects, but it goes one step further. I think when you realise that, or if you've ever met any holy people, and I often ask people, have you met anyone that's holy, especially a holy woman? And people think about it and they say, yes, well, you know, they can think of people in their lives that were like that. And I've seen so many. We had one friend who had been a heroin addict, and his encounter with the Catholic faith and his eventual conversion. And he was right. He was a heavy drug user. He was an anarchist. He was at one stage a Satanist. He really got the whole. He was meeting Mother Teresa's nun in Fitzroy, and they took him in. And their kindness to him, and their vigorous intellectual life. They sort of grasp for the faith, almost authenticity. I remember one sister in that community was a German sister who used to go up on the roof because she'd been a tiler in Germany. She put tiles on roofs.
But she had nothing.
She put tiles on roofs. That's what she did. And she said, I still go up on the roof and I just mend things. And I put, and I think meeting these women, none of whom fitted into anyone's expectations of what, you know, sisters might do. I think him meeting, I can understand why he felt so accepted, and they assisted him in getting off his drugs. They gave him charity, but they also gave him friendship and love. And I think, you know, it really changed his life.
Mm. I've been really convicted lately about we can't shame people back to the faith. We have to love them.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And I think a great example of that is the work of the Sisters of Life in New York. And they are just doing such powerful work. And they are really, for me, examples of that spiritual motherhood. It's not just, it's not spiritual in the sense airy-fairy.
No.
When we say spiritual, we'll kind of think, oh, you're going to say om and hope everyone gets better. It's very hands-on and it's sometimes quite gritty work, but it is such a powerful witness to people. And the sisters, I know, run retreats for women who've been through abortion and things like that. And in a way, I think their witness is far more powerful than lots of women.
Absolutely.
Even though words have a place, but I think presence, helping somebody find healing, recognizing the truth of the pain that people have been through.
Yeah.
All of those things these women do so well.
Yeah.
And
seeing what they have been through, acknowledging the pain that they're actually feeling.
Exactly.
And accepting them.
And often the isolation too. Often those women have been through lives of terrible abuse and terrible isolation. And so where they have been is a real hell.
Yeah. What holy women have you come across?
I've met a lot, actually. I've been very lucky and sometimes in very unusual places. When I was doing theology, there was a very old lady who had taught music in England, and she'd been in an abusive marriage, and she came to Australia with her 5 children. She was a great theologian. She was just at the age of 70. She was starting to do some study in theology, and I remember thinking, wow, this woman is amazing. She was one example. She was a Carmelite tertiary. And she, just as a lay woman, but her depth of understanding of their own spirituality was amazing. She stayed with me a long time. And there's many examples like that. She was outstanding. I got a glimpse of Mother Teresa when she came to Australia.
You did?
That was an amazing. Yeah, I did. And came out, I was very little, I think, at the time. But I think some of the women in my own family.
Yeah.
Their lives of prayer and their different way of praying, my grandmother. All of them had been a great example of that. But I've worked in it through things like the Catholic Women's League and other groups, and they were an amazing movement, particularly in the early years where they, in Victoria, they were called the Catholic Social, what are they called? The Catholic Social name. Isn't that terrible? They're Catholic.
I don't know.
Killed.
I'm thinking Catholic Justice Mission. That's something completely different.
Yeah, they were called the Social Guild, Catholic and Social Guild. And really, in a way, they were like the first social workers. And I was very blessed to be involved in the early research into the life of their first president, whose name is Dr. Mary Glowry. And she's now servant of God, so her cause has been introduced.
Oh, wow.
So she began her life as a doctor was a very early women doctor in Australia, and she studied at Melbourne University and became the first president of the Catholic Women's Social Guild, and left to go to India in 1920 because she believed that she had a vocation to help mothers and babies, particularly because the infant mortality and maternal mortality in India was so horrendous. And she thought, well, I have to do this as a sister because I want to bring them both Jesus and healing. So it's a beautiful part. So she is a phenomenal person and lived the rest of her life in India died of breast cancer. But I think we'll hear a lot more about Mary Glary in the years to come.
Awesome.
So she's a Victorian holy woman, a bit like Mary McKillop.
Yeah.
But you can see the impact. It goes much further than Melbourne. So.
Yeah. Well, one day we'll be talking about you too, I'm sure.
I think I'm a bit petty. But yes, it's been great to encounter her. And recently I heard her talk about Eileen O'Connor. She's another amazing figure.
She's a Sydney one. And we've got one from New South Wales.
Here's one from New South Wales. So there's a little bit of a holy competition going on between the two holy women. There's also not even started as causes, Mrs. Caroline Chisholm, who, again, did some great work around Australia before she returned to England.
Mm-hmm.
So she's another person whose name has been recognised in social work circles, civic circles, because in Victoria there's whole suburb named after her. Caroline Springs is named after Mrs. Caroline Chisholm. And we have Chisholm electorate. So some of the early people involved in social work recognised her.
Okay. I didn't know she was Catholic.
Family welfare.
I know she's on the $5 note. That's about it.
Exactly. But she was a great Catholic woman. And she's often... So she's another one. So we have a whole string of amazing... In fact, I'm going to an exhibition tonight, which will be... there's a German artist who's painted in a modern style, a bit like Andy Warhol's style. She painted a whole lot of whole women. The exhibition's called Great Women of Faith and the Catholic Women's League in Victoria and Wagga Wagga have contributed to funding or is sponsoring this exhibition, which will be at St. Patrick's Cathedral. So if anyone's in Melbourne over the next 10 days, hop in and see these women. But three of them are Australian women. I think three or four, maybe it's four Australian women. Her interpretation of Mary Glary, Caroline Chisholm and Eileen O'Connor.
Okay.
Not Caroline Chisholm. Sadly, not Caroline. No, Mary McKillop's in there.
No, Mary.
But she also has paintings. She has holy great women from China, South Australia, South America, and other more traditional saints like Saint Therese. And her portrait of Saint Therese is really quite startling because she's got her painted as a young woman with purple hair.
Oh.
It really makes you see Therese in a different light. So we'll see. I haven't seen these pictures in actual size, but I've seen some of the catalogues. So.
Okay. I'll put it in the show notes. So if you're around Melbourne, St. Pat's Cathedral in the next 10 days, have a look.
Yeah, pop in and have a look, yeah. And I think she's really done this because she wants to, her name's Barbara Rupner, and she wanted women to really think about these figures as contemporary women and their contribution. So I think the idea was that we were going to run this exhibition to coincide with International Women's Day.
Okay,
to
sort
of say, well, our recognition of great women is their holiness, and here they are. So it'll be very interesting.
That's great. It's the 8th of March, isn't it, International Women's Day?
Yeah, that's right. It is, yeah. So I don't know when you broadcast, but it might coincide.
Well, I'll push you up the queue and you can go before the other ones that I've already got recorded.
Well, I also, you know, one of the things that I've been just delighted to do is work with other women through the Anima Women's Network.
Uh-huh.
Our motto is sort of nurturing the soul, nurturing the soul of women. So our resources are things like, a bit like the work you're doing, we do retreats. We encourage women to write on spiritual matters. And people can find us on our blog page is animawomen.com.
I'll put all that in the show notes so people can find you.
Yeah, and anima means the soul. So it's sort of soul care.
I love it.
So that's one of the areas.
I was looking when I did a little bit of research about you. You wrote an article a few years ago about my brother-in-law's father. His name is Bob Dennehy. How did you know him?
I knew Bob for a very long time. I met him. He was the very first man I'd met who had taken on the role of homeschooling.
Uh-huh.
And he had been a master at Geelong Grammar. And he had a great love of G.K. Chesterton.
Yeah, he did.
So he used to tell us all about that. And he's, so you're married to Peter, are you?
No, my sister is married to Paul.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah, he was an amazing fellow, and his wife Mariko is a lovely woman too. And I think we met them. They were living in the country of Victoria, and I was fascinated by him taking on this task of home educating his children. But he was doing it so well. He was really quite an innovator in that way. He was also involved in sort of applying social teaching in the area that he lived. So he was a really dynamic figure.
Yeah, and they used to house Vietnamese refugees as well.
They did. They did. I remember that. And my father did that too. That might have been how we actually met.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think I interviewed him once. And then I had an interview with Tom, his son, to try and write the article when Bob passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sort of know that one of his sons is a country and western singer.
Yeah.
Tom's a tennis player. And I don't, the two other children, Susan and Paul. Yeah, great. So you're related to them. It's an amazing family.
Huh.
The Australian Japanese connection.
Yeah, beautiful family with a beautiful faith.
Yeah. Yeah. So yes, indeed, a very strong. Yeah.
Oh well,
they were quite impressive, and the time the children lived in regional rural Australia, and they do their lessons at home, and they used to go out and then be with the stockmen who were making the Man from Snowy River at the time. So they were really interested in sort of Australian bush culture. So it was a great combination.
Yeah, Paul he has some amazing stories. They used to go out in the morning, in the cold Victorian winter mornings, with a little cup with Milo at the bottom, and they'd go and milk the cow, and they'd get fresh, frothy, hot chocolate.
That's really amazing. I think when I interviewed Tom, we had some funny stories about how, in some ways, Bob kind of learnt on the job, as it were. So there were a few funny stories of things that didn't go quite so well in there, living on the land. But he was a bit ahead of his time. He was ahead of his time in terms of getting back to the land, and they ran a film processing shop
in
Harcourt to start with, and then they moved to different locations and eventually up to Sydney.
Well, Mariko still loves taking photographs. She always prints out photographs. You know, that's it.
Yeah.
It's a loss. It's a loss to art these days. We just, have them in the cloud or on our phone.
Yeah, they met in the Kodak shop in Nagasaki, I think, or Hiroshima. I can't remember. One of those.
Is that right?
He was an Australian travelling through Japan, in Japan. And he met Mariko. And I don't think initially she spoke very much English. So it's a great story. It's a great love story. Great story.
Yeah, it's a beautiful story. But she, you know, from busy Nagasaki, and then ended up in rural Victoria, it would have been such a culture shock for her.
And she's still living in regional Victoria, as far as I know. I think she lives in Yakandanda.
Yeah.
With near her son, Peter.
Yeah.
Peter, one of my favourite stories was that Peter and Tom and maybe some of the other family run tours through Japan of bluegrass cafes in Japan.
Yeah.
I think that's the best story.
They still do it.
So they still do it.
Yeah.
I was saying to a friend, wouldn't that be a great trip to go on? It would be so much fun.
So much fun. Yeah. Paul, Bob's wake was so much fun. We were down in Yakandana, and then Pete was there playing music till all hours. It was such a blast.
I didn't know that you. Oh, that's a fantastic connection. That's great, Jessica.
Yeah. Well, I only realised that when I was Googling you last night, and I thought, she's written a story about Bob.
Yes, all these characters that have been part of our history. Really, I'm compelled to write about them because quite often they don't appear very much on the internet. You know, once the digital resources. Someone once said to me, you can find everything on Google. That's not quite true. The histories of some of these characters, these really amazing figures, don't get record, don't translate into digital very well, and often stories are just left with their family. So I do love.
Yeah, the and they need stories. To be told. They're such beautiful stories.
Really do. Yeah, they really do. So I do a lot of writing for. You probably will find that I have written for the Catholic Weekly and the Record, and you know, I'm still writing every week. So that's wonderful.
I saw that you've written a lot. I'm going to have to do a lot of reading. I like reading and I like writing. So you've left me a lot to do.
I'm working my way up to podcasts and video, and in Thomas More we've trying to explore different mediums. So that's good fun.
Awesome. And I thank you for your time. It was a joy to chat with you, and wonderful to hear all the good things you're doing. And just, you know, to hear about women of faith, that we are so different, but our differences are not, shouldn't be something that tear us apart. Our faith is what brings us together, and we can live out our faith knowing that it's not something. That is, I love the fact that people think that to be Catholic woman is very stereotypical, and it's not. We are so diverse and different.
And I think the other thing is that the great women of our faith too have encouraged what I call feminine maturity. Like, they've had to face in their own personality often things that in our own time would be recognised as mental health issues. St. Catherine of Siena, for instance, or even St. Therese. Who at the end of her life, of course, had experienced absolutely shattering depression, but was able to I think there's a sort of serious adult side to the faith of many Catholic women who are holy, that really we could hear a lot more about, and it would really help women around the world to know that.
Absolutely.
I think sometimes people are missing out on how rich those, and starting with people. Starting with the women of the Gospels, of course. Mary Magdalene and all the girls that became Jesus' disciples. They were feminine, what I call feminine disciples. And all of them in some ways had been healed in their encounter with him.
Absolutely. I love how he takes me on this journey. So I get introduced to certain women of the Bible, and it's like, come and meet this woman. So last year it was Veronica. I had no, I'd never really delved into many women of the Bible, but there are so many and they're so varied. And he heals them. And he does the same for us too. And it's just so personal and hopeful and beautiful.
I was thinking the other day of the woman who was healed of the hemorrhage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she was reluctant to come forward. She just thought, I'll just sneak up and touch a tiny little bit. And he turns the whole dynamic of that scene around by saying, who was that?
Show
and
me.
Someone said, well, he had so many people pressing on him. He said, was there a crowd? And I must say, I think the series of The Chosen did a really interesting job of interpreting her. And they have her in a number of the series. So it's quite interesting how they portrayed that woman. But I think it's a very interesting insight into her.
This year it's the Samaritan woman at the well who I'm getting to know very well.
Yeah, she's a wisecracker. She jokes.
Is she?
She's quite sharp. So she says, oh, you say this, I'll say. And then Jesus ups the ante every time he replies to her. Very, very, it's very remarkable and very subtle conversation that goes on there.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's beautiful. Anna, before we go, I ask all my guests something that brought them joy this week. Can you think of anything that's brought you joy this week?
Yeah, two things. One, that my niece and nephew, who were evacuated from the fires a couple of times, were safe. Just seeing them all safe and happily back home, that was great. That was a point. But another more sort of long-lasting joy, I guess, was just working with my young colleagues in Thomas More Centre. They're just so gifted and so open and so enthusiastic. It was great working with these who are much younger than me, but being able to have great conversations with them and explore the work we're doing together, that's been a joy.
It gives you such hope, so too, doesn't it?
It does. It does. Really, really deeply impressive people who really made huge commitments and are studying things and working on things and just do it with joy and enthusiasm. Just amazing.
Gives me that's wonderful.
So I'll send you the link to our Facebook page and people are very welcome to
receive
our newsletter.
I'd love to receive your newsletter and I'll put it in the show notes so others can too.
Yeah, great. Very welcome.
All right. Thank you so much, Anna. Go and enjoy that exhibition. And
yeah, I'll send you all that.
Hopefully one day we can get you up to Sydney and you can speak at one of the retreats.
Good delight. Thank you. Good delight.
Awesome. Thank you.
All the best to all your listeners too. Love to hear more stories about the listeners. It sounds fantastic.
You will. Thanks.